years come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
The following excerpt is from the summer edition of the Quail Forever Journal. I sit at a curious crossroads where wild quail taunt us with the promise of a future hunt. Caged quail provide us with a counterfeit ideal of a quail hunt, and a phone call can summon endless quail whose entire purpose is to taste good. For now, it seems that the three quail I know, the wild, the stocked, and the farmed, will have to represent the entire muddled relationship I have with these gorgeous, vulnerable, tasty, and sporty birds. Those are the words of Jesse Griffiths, a restaurateur, chef, cooking instructor, and James Beard award-winning food writer from Texas. And I'm thrilled to be joined by Jesse Griffiths for today's episode. And riding shotgun with me, first time as co-host, Ryan Sparks, the editor of the Quail Forever Journal. Ryan, Jesse, thanks very much for joining me for this episode of On the Wing podcast. We'll start with Ryan, since this is your only your second time on the podcast. Can I remind folks who maybe didn't listen to your introductory episode a little bit about who you are, how long you've been on with the organization, and a little bit about your role?
Sure. Yeah, I'm the somewhat new editor of Quail Forever Journal. I've got a couple issues under my belt now, and having Jesse on us, we have a new column in our coming issue called The Hunter's Table, and Jesse is our first contributor for that, so excited to have him on board. Set a high bar for future contributors.
Yeah, and so you mentioned you've had a couple issues under your belt. This summer issue is really the first one where there weren't, for folks that maybe aren't involved in the print business, a lot of stuff is planned out pretty far in advance. And the baton, Tom Carpenter, the editor of the Pheasants Forever Journal, was serving as the de facto Quail Forever Journal while we were in the hiring process. In the spring issue, he'd carried quite a ways along. The summer issue is really kind of your first vision. What beyond the kind of the hunter's table, where do you intend to take the Quail Forever members?
Sure. Yeah. So this issue, like you said, is really, it's my baby, my first one, that I've done completely myself. Just a good mix of, conservation, mission content, as well as just interesting things to read. I think things like the Hunter's Table bring it full circle. The food that we get from hunting is a big part of that. The feedback we've got so far, we just did the cover reveal the other day, and we've got just a ton of great feedback on it's a watercolor of a Bob White from the artist Ryan Keene, and just the amount of positive feedback we've got on that so far has been awesome. In the coming issue, we also have a profile of the legendary Southwest author Stephen Bodio. We've got a huge announcement for Bob White quail conservation, and just a lot of other great things packed into that issue. So a lot of great content in 88 pages coming our members' way. And
yeah, you're right. The image, the watercolor of the cover, has been met with resounding applause. That's a really, really cool image. And you really brought up the food connection in your interview, which was something that definitely resonated with me. As we record this, I'm holding Jesse's copy of A Field, which I've owned for many years. Consider Hank Shaw a close friend. Food has always been a critically important component to my love of the outdoors, my love of bird hunting, my love of conservation. I think it's people that don't have that same celebration of the final success of the hunt on the plate, I think are missing home plate. You know, like you've rounded third and you got stranded on third at the end of the inning. Like you gotta get, there's your baseball reference for folks. You gotta cross home plate. And for me, that was that definitely stuck out in your interview. And I'm really thrilled to see you running full steam ahead with the Hunter's Table. And, you know, as we've, you know, gone 5 minutes here with Jesse sitting quietly, and even listening to his words being read back to him. Why don't we introduce Jesse? Ryan, go ahead and tell us how you met Jesse and give him your introduction as we bring Jesse into the conversation.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, just to piggyback off what you just said, I really think that knowing how to cook and have that knowledge of preparing wild game is really the other half of hunting. So it's a big part of my life. My wife and I, outside of a pack of bacon every once in a while, we don't buy any meat from the grocery store. So I've just been really interested in wild food for a long time. You know, I started off, I also have Jesse's cookbook, Afield. I just became aware of him from the Hog book, his new turkey book, his restaurant, Daidue, and then you know, he's in the meat eater orbit as well. I'm a big fan of meat eater, so I think anybody that's kind of tuned in to wild food, Jesse's somebody you should know of. And I mean, honestly, how we met each other, I just reached out on Instagram and was like, hey, what's your experience with quail? And he was like, well, it's actually kind of a little conflicted, interesting story. I don't really know if I could really contribute. And the more we talked, I was like, actually, that sounds like a very honest, real relationship that a lot of people have with wild quail. So I can let kind of Jesse take it from there and speak to that.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me. It is interesting to be able to get out of my normal boundaries a bit and talk about something that I was trying to be right up front about, that I'm not much of an expert on as far as seeing wild quail. But yeah, as I alluded to in that passage you read, I definitely have cooked thousands of them before. But yeah, I'm very happy to be here and sounding off with, you know, those, your stance on eating game. I obviously couldn't agree more that, you know, I wish that people were able to enjoy every single bit of it through the preparation, the drive out there, the hunt, and then eating it, which I think is the final act in that play. And so I like the baseball reference too, though.
It's one of my greatest pet peeves with any sort of hunters where they, you know, at the start of a new season, they go into their chest freezer and they sort of clean out from years past, and things that they, you know, birds, animals that they've killed have now died a second death of freezer burn. And that to me is such an egregious violation of the hunter's ethic. And it's such a waste of unbelievable flavors. And, you know, just to start a new season by emptying out your freezer and throwing away the last year. Like, I know that happens and it just drives me crazy. You know, when it comes to pheasants and quail, I think that's probably more rare because it's such an approachable, they're more approachable birds. But I know that happens with stronger meats, ducks and geese and sharp tails. And send it my way, 1783 Berkeley Circle, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55110, Pheasants Forever, attention Bob St. Pierre. Put it in dry ice and I'll take care of it for you.
Yeah, it is a real shame. I mean, there's also, I think at the end of the beginning of the season, what I tend to do is gather up all the old stuff and make just a big batch of something out of that. You know, usually it's going to be like bolognese with basically like a Noah's Ark lineup in there, just a little bit of everything. And then I convert that into something that's smaller, making room in the freezer, and still totally enjoyable. And I'm not buying it that after a year, it's no good to eat. I think that we can be a little lazy sometimes, and it's unfortunate, and it's wasteful, and it's disrespectful to the resource too.
Yeah, and I'll chime in there. If anybody's going into the season and they still have some birds in their freezer, in our current issue, we have a recipe for an upland game bird rillette. It's a great way to combine all sorts of different types of birds. And, you know, as you're going into a season, I think a nice thank you from landowners is a little jar of rillette to enjoy. It's a way that they will definitely remember you if you give them a little jar of that. You will stand out from the crowd. So check that out.
Yeah, that's a great point. So that's in the spring issue. Jesse's article is in the summer issue. If you are not yet a member and you're listening to this, it sounds like the Jerry Lewis telethon right now. But if you're not a member of Quail Forever, join now. Drop me or Ryan an email, bobs@quailforever.org or rsparks@quailforever.org. Let us know you just joined, and we'll send you a copy of the spring issue, and you can get that rillette recipe, and then you'll be lined up to get Jesse's article too. Jesse, tell us a little bit, just as we get going here, about who you are, like what's your background? Where are you from? Are you a lifelong hunter? Like, give us the Jesse Griffiths origin story.
Okay, I'll try to make it short and more digestible. I'm born and raised in Texas. I grew up in North Texas, and currently live in Austin, so in Central Texas. I been fishing since I was since I can remember, essentially. Started hunting later in life. Probably in my late 20s. But before I started hunting, I had worked in restaurants as a butcher and just pretty much every other position you can fill in a kitchen, from dishwasher to, you know, I made pasta, baked, pastry, all this stuff. But I think the butchery was part of it that I really enjoyed. And so coming into hunting kind of a backwards, I knew how to break down birds and fish and game animals before I hunted, and so I think that was pretty helpful. And then after that, in 2006, started up a business called Daidue, which was a supper club at the time, kind of a pop-up. Did that for a few years, went to the farmer's market, sold sausages there and pickles and cooked hot food. And then almost 10 years ago, we're about to come up on our 10-year anniversary for the restaurant, we opened our brick-and-mortar restaurant, Daidue, which is in downtown, not downtown, but central Austin. And have also hosted a hunting school since 2009, where we teach people how to shoot, clean, cook, you know, butcher, everything, you know, start to finish, lodging, meals, everything is included. So I've been doing that and all kinds of instruction as far as that goes. And we'll cover pretty much any wild topic, from fish. It's mostly deer and hogs. We'll do ducks in season. We've definitely done doves as well. So kind of just any wild topic that we'll cover out there. And then I've authored three books. The one that you were talking about, A Field, which came out a long time ago, it feels like. It was probably, I think that was 2012. And then The Hog Book, which came out a couple years ago, which is all about feral hogs. And The Turkey Book, which came out in March, and I'll just let you guess what that's about. And so just, I've been keeping busy, I guess. Yeah.
You have been. I'm looking for I've got A Field in front of me. It looks like 2010. Does that sound right?
Oh, okay. All right.
If it makes you feel old, I was a senior in college when I got that book. It was my
very
first
wild game. Published in 2012. You're right. I was looking at wrong place, but in a preface written, or the foreword written by Andrew Zimmern, another Minnesotan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So, he was very kind to do
Daidue. Did I pronounce it right? Daidue?
What? You did. Yes.
How would you describe the menu for your restaurant?
It's excessively local. Like we only use what we can find locally. So there'll be a couple of exceptions, which I'll go into here in a second. But every meat, vegetable, all the dairy, the olive oil, fruit, cheese, name it, comes from Texas sources, and most of that pretty close to Austin. So that really defines our menu. Our menu changes a lot. Our menu is very simple. A lot of steaks, a lot of... a lot of pork chops. We serve a lot of quail, and then also a lot of wild game that we're able to legally source, like feral hog and exotic deer, things like the Nilgai antelope, axis, sika, fallow, and then goldfish as well. So real simple menu, very much focused on being grilled over wood. So we just have a big hearth and just try to treat everything with as much respect as far as the food goes. And it works. I love it. I actually ate there last night. But one of the perks is just sometimes I'm like, I don't feel like doing the dishes. So went in there and it's good. But I think it's very straightforward. I think it really represents Texas very well. Like if somebody, we have a lot of people that travel that come into the restaurant, and I really love that they, you know, you can go get barbecue, you can get things that are emblematic of our cooking culture. But if you want to just really taste the food from here in a very simple and thoughtful manner, that's it. And including all of our wine comes from Texas, all of our beer, all of our non-alcoholic drink program. It's like, it's pretty, it can be hard to manage sometimes, but also it's also fun to have a discussion why we don't have lemons most of the year. And it's just like, well, we just don't have lemons yet. They'll come in October, I hope. You know, and then you can have lemons in your iced tea. And then, but our iced tea is made out of Yopon holly leaves, which is an invasive plant down here that actually contains caffeine. So, I always use the tea metaphor to kind of encapsulate what we're doing. It's like you can have tea. It's made out of an invasive weed, basically. It's very good. It tastes just like tea. And you can have a lemon with that tea, maybe October through February.
So you've got some name recognition in the hunting world. You know, Ryan mentioned Meat Eater. You know, you've written these books that connect with the hunting audience. When you think about your customers at the restaurant, do you have a significant portion of people coming through traveling? Because Austin's a destination that people take vacations to. Are they coming because they know the name Jesse Griffiths and the connect as hunting, or is it more of a local destination? Break down the audience for me a little bit. Do you think there's a traveling component, or is it primarily local?
It's a bit of both. I mean, we'll see a lot of times, you know, at lunch you can go in and you can see people still have their suitcases from the airport, and they wanted to come in there because they've heard of it. And, you know, like I was saying, it's something that I really enjoy thinking about is just people travel, and then if they've done their research and they want to eat something, you know, local or the game aspect really attracts people because people have never had Nilgai or Audad sheep, which we are able to source. And so things like that attracts them. We have a pretty steady local following as well. People that are, you know, and also there's some people that are just in it for health reasons. You know, we source very fresh ingredients. You know, our vegetables are typically organic. We are a seed oil free restaurant. So everything is cooked in lard and tallow and butter, olive oil. I think we get a mixture of people wanting to come there from curiosity, tourism, health reasons, or they just love food. they just like steak, you know. So, which is we have that too, and it's a really good one. So yeah, it's hard to kind of break down, but I definitely have seen, you know, from Meat Eater and being in the hunting realm, you will see a lot of people there, you know, just the guy in the camo hat, you know, like, oh, I bet I can figure out what demographic he's in there, you know. So that does happen a lot as well, and I'm very, very thankful for that.
So we'll get to quail, but I've got one more squirrel brain question for you that Austin's way up there on my list of places that I'd like to visit. I mean, it seems like it's a cool place. And the three things that I think about with Austin are food, music, and bats. Okay. Accurate top three reasons to go visit Austin, or am I off my rocker?
I know. I think you're absolutely right. The bats, I would prioritize like natural beauty a little bit more. It is a very beautiful city, and it's also a jumping off point to a lot of very beautiful places in Texas. Like if you've never experienced Texas, I love when people come here for the first time and they're like oil derricks and like horses and desert and big cactuses. And it's like, no, that's not what it's like here at all. And it's, I mean, some of it can be pretty breathtaking, especially in certain times of year, those times being not summer. I think it's a very pretty place. We have these big rivers and, to the east, it's just these dense hardwood forests and then, you know, prairies and plains. And then there's the coast and the hill country and there's all kinds of things here. So, but the bats, I'd say, would be part of the natural beauty that we have that is very interesting. Is, you know, just these massive colonies of bats that fly out every night and control some of our mosquitoes. I would say that number three would just have to be the outdoor space. Cool.
Music, if you were to categorize what Austin music, is there a genre or is it all over the board?
It's all over the board. You know, of course we get, you know, the whole full spectrum of like country from like new country to like very traditional. But I mean, I think, you know, with Willie Nelson and then Waylon and the whole crew that used to kind of base out of here, we're still kind of a bastion for that old school style country. You know, there's still lots of little bars and taverns and stuff around here that you can go and hear some really good music.
Cool. All right. Ryan, we'll get to quail now. So I read, Jesse, in the opening. So I'll read it back. For now, it seems that the three quail I know, the wild, the stocked, and the farmed, will have to represent the entire muddled relationship I have with these gorgeous, vulnerable, tasty, and sporty birds. And the word muddled to me is such an important one in that composed sentence. And it definitely portrays a sense of conflict in your mind. You know, as a Minnesotan or Michigander, my roots, I think about Texas, I think quail capital of the country. You know, the more quail are shot in Texas than any other state. It's the Bob White quail state that pheasants are to South Dakota. But you definitely portray a sense of conflict there. Maybe add a little bit more to your thoughts about, as a Texan, in your relationship with Bob White quail.
Certainly. I think in any opportunities that I have to access land or hunt or explore, really, there may or may not be quail there, and they're almost never on the menu as far as hunting. The landowners are going to be protective of them for one reason or another. I mean, no, for one reason only, really. And that's to preserve them, to get them back to this almost mystical future time where quail populations are going to be much better. And that's not to say that we don't have great quail populations here in Texas. Absolutely do. Native quail still exists in the, you know, southern part of the state. And then in the west, there's blue quail. I just personally have never had access to that. It's kind of, I don't want to say guarded, but it's harder to gain entry to properties like that. And with the weather and all the other factors that, you know, which occupy so much of talk about quail is these other factors, is the fire ants and the weather and habitat loss, predation, things like that, you know, where it's like you spend so much of your time talking about all the other things that want to eat quail, or that are taking out the quail, that sometimes it really occupies this everything that we're talking about. And so I think that, you know, especially the ranch that I work with mostly, that's where I've really kind of codified this relationship that I have with quail, in that the landowner there grew up hunting quail in a very traditional way. They had, you know, these old cars built just for it. It was, you know, really, really cool, like custom built stuff, or they would ride horses. And then at the end of the hunt, they would have these white tablecloths and wine, and they would have these big dinners, and it was this very nostalgic thing for that family. And we still will bump a quail covey regularly, you know, just scares you to death when you're out there like hunting hogs or turkey, and all of a sudden, you know, at your feet, you're not expecting it. And it happens enough. And then afterwards, when your heart rate comes back down, you feel great about it. But they're still not to a point where we're feeling like we can hunt them. And it's a very interesting relationship in that there's across the road from this ranch is a stocked quail operation where, you know, you can go and hunt quail all day long there. You know, they're putting them out in the field, and you just go and watch the dogs. And it's objectively fun. It's a good time. And then you do wind up with a bunch of quail that you can eat too, but it's such a different thing, to experience this very vulnerable native population. And then literally across the highway, you can have this other experience. And then the other thing that I allude to is just the fact that I'm, you know, in the restaurant industry, and we buy quail. You know, I'm friends with one of the biggest quail producers in the state, and he has a very high quality, delicious, semi boneless product. And so, being able to order quail at any moment, and just cases and cases and cases of them. So, I've cooked literally thousands of quail. And we cook them they're always on the menu, but there is just these very different relationships that I've had with quail, and they still fascinate me. And it's something I would very much love to hunt, because it's the style of hunting, the history, the dogs, the way that you go about it. You know, it's very social. There's a lot of walking involved, which, I mean, whenever I love walking and hunting, it's a very important thing to me. And then it's something I would like to experience more, but sometimes I just get the feeling that maybe I've resigned myself to being like, this is the relationship that I will always have with wild quail. It's kind of this tenuous thing where I scare some wild ones up. I could go across the street and pay some money and do it. And then I can just pick up a phone and have 10 cases delivered by tomorrow morning.
You're alluding to a variety of things that from the outside we hear about Texas. Some of those things are, in order to hunt wild quail in Texas, you do have to pay to play, that it's a real challenge to find wild quail on public lands. Yet I hear the reverse of that from time to time too, that, you know, there's actually an abundance of public land, and just people don't go out and search for them on public lands in Texas. What's your experience been, your perspective? Are there public lands hunters actively going out in Texas, or is that just not in the world that you're connected to?
Oh, I am connected to that. I'm very aware of a lot of the public lands here, and you know, spent some time on a lot of them too. As far as specifically speaking of quail, I don't think that many of our public hunting areas would hold very good populations of quail, and then they would also have to be on the legal menu as well. There might be a couple places in far south Texas that it's possible. And I mean, to your point though, I don't know if I've ever heard of anybody hunting quail on public land in Texas. You know, definitely doves. Definitely people will go after deer and hogs, nilgai, things like that. But I don't think so. But I would say that that's going to be pretty tough. But I mean, if you're looking for a challenge, of course. But Texas is a private land state. And I would say that most of the good quail hunting, you know, that's been managed is not only private and pay to play, but it might even be to the point where it's a family only deal, which this is generally what I see, is that there's a property and the quail are kind of reserved for family and friends only. And it's not really something that they're selling off. And I do think that goes back to that nostalgic, that traditional connection that people here, and I think everywhere, have with the notion of quail hunting. It's just not just shooting quail and eating them, but the whole routine the very genteel process that involves. And I think that's kind of an act of preservation, mm-hmm. in a way, when people on private land here kind of restrict that.
You talked a few minutes ago, you were talking about you saw a lot of quail at the restaurant and people really enjoy them. And I'm wondering, like, if you can project for a minute, like, you see these people eating quail that you bought from a farm, and I'm assuming they fall in love with the taste of quail. Do they ask you questions? Do they take that next step mentally to, you know, what can we do to improve habitat for these birds because they're wonderful on the plate? And like, do people, so we often think about falling in love with a bird through hunting it, following a dog, and then eating it. Like, the food is sort of the last step in the falling in love process. But my question, long-winded though it may be, is kind of, do you see it happening in reverse? Where the food is actually the first step in the falling in love because they haven't ever experienced the hunt and the dog, but they taste it on the plate and they're like, wow, this bird is amazing. Like, what can we do to make this more approachable?
Yeah. And I think it is very notable. And as you know, quail hunters might sometimes forget, because they're exposed to the entire process, how uniquely delicious quail are. I mean, they're just very, very good. They're one of the best eaten animals out there. You know, I love turkey a lot. And I think that, you know, through the lens of the turkey, it's kind of the same thing. What you're saying is that you eat them and you're like, oh, that's, I mean, pretty extraordinary. It's beyond good. I want to hunt that more, which is what happened for me. I hunted them a little bit. I'm speaking of turkeys right now. And then started to hunt them more just sheerly because I just wanted to eat them more. And I enjoyed the hunt too. You know, it's like, I mean, I'm not, you know, I spent 23 days hunting turkeys this year. So it's the caloric impact is probably not there. But to your point, then that leaves you exactly in reverse. And then all of a sudden you're deeply involved in turkey conservation. And so, yeah, I think it absolutely is a gateway. Any kind of recruitment, though, is, and especially if somebody's going to come at it from a food standpoint, great. You know, if they're like, oh, I really enjoy eating game because of flavor, health aspects, sustainability, whatever that is, they're going to enter, if they eat that and it piques their curiosity, they're going to enter into hunting. They're going to purchase some gear, and then they're going to unknowingly contribute to conservation there through taxation, which is great. And then soon enough, they're going to find themselves joining a quail conservation group or a turkey conservation group and things like that, or just participating more, or just becoming interested in being a steward. So, yeah, that might be people that are coming into hunting as older people, you know, like maybe in their 20s and 30s and 40s or whatever. You know, they might start with food and then work in reverse. They have a garden. They have a couple chickens. And they're like, what's the next step on this? And it's like, well, I think we all know, you know? Yep. And then they go out there, and then before you know it, they're conservationists, which I think is an excellent point. I mean, so far, you guys are like, I feel like you're fascinating podcast hosts. Like, you make so many good points. I love it. Like, very, very, very good. It's very enjoyable listen. So I just wanted to make that point real quick.
That's high praise coming from you. That really means a lot. You know, it's interesting because what we're talking about is the locavore movement, right? I mean, the locavore movement, at least in that term, has been around for 15, 20 years, but it's always referenced, in my perspective, it's always referenced with, like, a white-tailed deer, or it's like, oh, gotta fill the freezer, you know? And it's like that connection to lots of meals. And I think people underestimate the power of a single meal and how it can have on a person's perspective. Like, yeah, white-tailed, hard to beat a whitetail, you know, tenderloin. I mean, I testify, you know, I get it. Mm-hmm. But, like, that magic of a little bobwhite quail on the plate paired with the right sides in a nice you know, beer, glass of wine, or whatever your flavor is. I mean, it can be life altering, you know, and it really connect Certainly. With you in that sense. I've talked about it a lot, like the things we eat and that sense of place, which is what you're connecting to with local ingredients, right? That's, it's all wrapped up together, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think that, you know, I've always said that, you know, you have that garden in your backyard and you have a shovel and a hoe and a rake. And then you also, another tool that you own is a shotgun. And once you kind of embrace all these as tools, it's all the same, I think. You know, it just all kind of fills that same void. Like, and if you care about where your quail comes from, then you're probably going to start noticing things like the quality of your carrots. You know, like, this carrot I got at the farmer's market is way better than that other carrot, you know, that dried up little thing from the store. So I absolutely agree. I also think that poultry, to get like more technical and specific, poultry as a cultural, let's say, food category is really important. Like, we as a nation eat a lot of chicken. And so we also eat a lot of beef. And so I'd say that, you know, your whitetail is going to kind of be a natural stand-in in the red meat category. And then you also need those stand-ins in the poultry category. And I grew up eating chicken and other kinds of poultry. And I'm, you know, in eating a quail at a young age. I remember the first meal. I think I talked about it in the story. But poultry is just a very important aspect in the freezer as well. I think, you know, it's, if you want to have a, and once you're into this, you're like, hey, I'm going to source much of my food, then you're going to have these categories that kind of need to be filled, whether it's, you know, a turkey and a dozen and a half quail and maybe a few ducks. And you've also got that whitetail down here. We're lucky / unlucky to have hogs. So I can make bacon. I don't have to go to the store for that. So, but be careful what you wish for. And things like that. But I do think that quail are an incredible gateway because they're very palatable, very approachable, and people recognize it. But it's just, it's a few notches more delicious than any poultry they've ever had.
Yeah, I think cooking wild game, a lot of times when people find out that that's mainly what we eat in our household, they're like, don't you miss beef? Don't you miss chicken? Don't you miss? And what they don't really realize is, like, there's some nuances, but for the most part, that deer can fit in, you can adapt a beef recipe for deer for the most part. You can adapt a chicken recipe for turkey or quail or pheasants or rough grouse. They're actually a lot more versatile game to cook with than most people realize. You don't a lot of times need a very specialized recipe for something like a quail, for example, is a very, it's almost like a blank canvas. Like the flavor is very subtle, and there's recipes I think that highlight that, but then there's also a lot of like interesting things you can do with them as well. And when you eat a lot of quail, I mean, it's nice to have a variety of recipes to go to. Along that line, you said you prepare quail all the time at your restaurant. I'm curious how, like, what preparations are you using at the restaurant for quail?
They're almost universally going to be grilled or stuffed. So we buy a semi-boneless quail. And so the rib cage and the backbone's been removed. The wings and legs are still in there. And it's about just as perfect of a little package as you can wish for. And they'll either grill in about 3 or 4 minutes perfectly. You know, with just trace of pink in there. We brine them and marinate them in honey and olive oil. And just a simple grilled quail is really wonderful. Very easy for the customer to eat as well. Or we'll stuff them. Like right now on the menu, we have them stuffed. We'll stuff them with usually some sort of wild boar sausage or, usually. Like, I mean, a lot of times in the winter, we stuff them with blood sausage and serve them with a puree of turnips, which, I mean, might sound kind of fancy, but it's just a fantastic way to taste all of those things because the quail really comes out, and I love turnips, and blood sausage is a very underrated thing. But I'd say, yeah, grilled or stuffed. And then on Sundays, we fry them, which interestingly, our chicken producer, after many, many years, she's just became too ill to provide us with chicken anymore. So we replaced our Sunday fried chicken with Sunday fried quail. And at first I was like, oh, you know, it felt wrong because we've been doing it for 10 years and it was in high demand and it was very good fried chicken. And then we replaced it with fried quail, and I was like, I got over it real quick. I was like, it's actually, it's very good. So, I mean, just the same way too, you know, with your mashed potatoes and gravy, braised greens or green beans when they come into season, and sweet and sour pickled jalapenos or cucumbers, depending on the season on that too. So, I mean, very traditional, approachable setup for that, but just fried quail sundaes. Mm. And so that's how we prepare them at the restaurant, you know, just try to let them shine as much as we can. And then the wild quail that I've cooked, you know, has always been usually grilled. I've also made a lot of paellas with them, which is quite good. You know, just take a half quail and brown it and then add your rice and all the other vegetables and the sofrito and then cook it all together. It's very, it looks really nice too, a quail paella, especially if you are doing it under a big oak tree outside. That's a good time. But that's, generally how I do it. And then also, you know, we'll save up all, like any kind of offal. Sometimes we'll get in quail livers, which are just amazing. Very mild. They make wonderful pates, and the little gizzards and hearts too can be made into terrines and pates. They're very, very good.
What do you say to people that don't save the hearts and gizzards out of quail and pheasants and rough grouse? Like, how much of a missed opportunity is that?
It's a big one. I'll have to speak in dove for a second. I'm notorious for plucking my doves. I will sit in a dove field and pluck doves because I enjoy it. I'm usually there with a friend or two. Maybe we're going to drink a beer and we're going to sit there and pluck doves until the sun goes down, or everybody else just breasts the bird out. And I find that to be very enjoyable. Not to mention, I get a lot more meat. I would say twice as much, maybe more than twice as much meat off of those doves. But those people are usually just, they don't care. They're like, why spend the time? And I always make the point, is like, well, how long did you drive to get here? Like, or, you know, in the case of like turkey hunting, it's like, how long did you sit under that tree? Until, I mean, how many days, you know? Don't talk to me about time and how long it takes. So once we were on a very big dove hunt, and I just started going around and asking everybody for their livers, and I saved up and I got about a pint of dove livers, a lot. And I made a dove liver pate just out of them. There's probably 80 livers in there or something like that. And it was excellent. And I just, you know, I had to kind of save them up a little bit, but I've also taken the hearts, livers, and gizzards out of doves and quail. And, you know, you make a sausage like a boudin, which is, you know, like about half rice and then half cooked giblets, or, you know, or just pork liver or whatever you're making it out of. And it really stretches it. And I think I had about 15 doves worth of gizzards, hearts, and livers. And I made some boudin with the rice, and then I mixed that with cream cheese, and then we stuffed that into peppers. And I think I fed 70 people as an appetizer with that. And it sounds like I'm making that up, but I was able to like stretch it and then stretch it again and still utilize it all. But in one way or the other, I took just the offal from a limit of doves and fed a ton of people with that. So there is something there. And I'm not out of any kind of like stingy or like financial obligation towards like, well, I got to get every penny out of this bird. To me, it not only is it a resource, not as only it's respectful, but it's really good. And it's worth it. It's just worth it to have that meal there. I love that. Even if it's one small meal for your family, if you just took all your hearts, livers, and gizzards out of some quail, you know, a dozen quail, you can make something really fun with that and enjoy that. And then know that you're just really just getting as much out of that resource and that experience as possible. Just like you're saying, it's home plate. And it's like, that's, you know, that's really, that's like a grand slam there when you get the you use it all up, you know, and you're making art with the feathers or something. I don't know. A pillow. I don't know. I've never done
that. Flies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tie jigs, crappie jigs.
I was checking
jigs.
That out in the turkey book the other night. Yeah, the crappie jigs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, go ahead.
Well, I use wild boar hides and deer tails and turkey feathers and all kinds of stuff and convert that into fish, which I take great pleasure in doing.
Yeah, you
can
talk
about
bringing it full circle.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, for sure. I would say too, just on a more simple note, I mean, so a lot of times people would say, well, I don't like the livers or I don't like heart. And I would say, number one, it's usually because they haven't tried them. First of all, there's just a cultural aversion to it for some reason. But if that's the case, I mean, one, give them to me and I'll take them home. And two, if somebody's out hunting by themselves and, oh, I don't like them or my family is not going to eat that, your dog is. I mean, at the very least, just give your dog a little reward. Put that in their food at the end of the day. Toss it to them when you're cleaning the birds. I know my dog sits there and just drools while I'm cleaning the birds. Like, come on, give me something. So,
yeah, and dirty rice, right? Just such an easy way
that's
magnificent. But again, it's super easy to make it happen with those bits. The other thing you mentioned a while back about, you know, when you're cooking quail, leaving it pink. And I always think about people that don't cook a lot of wild game. They hear, you know, well, Steve Rinella got trichinosis out of bear, or, you know, there's this intimidation with all wild foods that they got to cook the shit out of it. And that's even true with quail. And that's, is it true or false? That's the absolute first mistake that a person's going to make, is that they overcook their quail. Is that the first problem that people go down with quail, Jesse?
I would say so. Maybe top two. I think quail are a lot harder to pluck than a dove. They can be difficult, but not impossible. And leaving the skin on quail, I think, is really imperative. And that'll help with what you're saying, and that's being overcooked. But I mean, just the fear of the pink, you know, that little trace of pink in there is unfounded. I mean, people would eat, you know, your duck breast medium rare routinely at a restaurant. And so you can absolutely eat a quail that's, you know, like medium well, and it's going to be fine. It's going to be more enjoyable. But yeah, there's, we encounter this a lot, especially with feral hogs. There's almost a mythological distrust and fear of their cleanliness, and it translates a lot. I could probably talk about this for an hour, how people treat wild game with like almost emotional responses, in that they're it's wild, they don't know what it ate, they think it's quote-unquote dirty, metaphorically dirty, and so they have to clean it, or they have to sterilize it through cooking. And I think there's a lot of things that are happening there, and it's just a fear of the unknown. And my position on that would be, like, the real unknown has happened at a slaughterhouse, you know, at a big, you know, factory farm. That's where the things that are unknown, or maybe you don't want to know, are happening. And I think the wild is a lot safer place for us to eat from. But yeah, you know, things like bear, of course, cook it through. Feral hog, you know, there's things that, you know, you want to take some steps on. But sure, overcooking quail is probably an issue. I do think that they kind of handle it a little better than a lot of other game meats, though. Like, you can slightly undercook or overcook a dove or a quail, or especially a quail. And it'll still usually come out pretty good, especially if you brined it or put a little marinade on it.
How would you brine a quail, and how long? Like, do you have a go-to? Do you have to do that overnight, or is it an hour? Like, give us just a quick brining quail 411.
Yeah, so just your salt needs to be dissolved, and the brine needs to be cold. And it goes in there for, you know, an hour or two or three, not very long, you know, definitely something that can happen midday and then be ready in time for dinner. I think that brining really works, and it seasons throughout, adds in a little bit of moisture, and then dry that off real well. And I usually throw quail in what I call a marinade, and you get some pushback on that word to be like, well, it doesn't really penetrate. And it's like, I'm not really worried about that. I'm more worried about the outside of it. I mean, if you want to call it a glaze, that's fine. But especially when you're grilling, the addition of like things like honey and olive oil, which is my go-to for glazes or marinades on quail, they caramelize really fast. And so you get the exterior, you get that beautiful char faster, which allows you to not overcook the interior. You know, and you've got those nice, deep, like dark grill marks on there, but the inside is still like a trace of pink. And the brine and the marinade are both contributing to that and helping with the caramelization that's happening on the outside.
I think, Jesse, your recipe that's going to be in the summer issue, I mean, it's a great example of both those things. You know, it's for brining those quail quickly. You know, the marinade with honey and olive oil. I believe there's rosemary in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say my wife and I eat a lot of quail. And for this recipe, you know, I always like to test them out. We made the recipe and my wife took a couple of bites and she said, "This is the best way we've ever made quail," which is high praise because we eat a lot of quail.
That's great. I love that. it's a fun recipe. I love that. It's also very easy. I mean, if you're organized about the brining and the marinating of the quail, beyond that, it's like a lot of just onions that you're just going to char on the grill. You're going to throw big slices of red onion on there. And then grapes. You've got that smoke. You've got a little acid from vinegar. And then you've got this sweetness from some grapes. And it's kind of a traditional Italian approach to game birds in its essence. But I think that also it just really highlights those simple flavors. You've got it seasoned with some salt. You've got some smoke on there. You've got a little bit of sweet from honey. You've got sweet from grapes. You've got acid from the vinegar. And you kind of just, you're covering all the bases. The whole spectrum is there, and it's a very simple dish. And then at the end of the day, you taste grapes, you taste rosemary, you taste onion, and most importantly, you taste quail.
It was great. And I put a little editor's note at the end of there. I said, don't make this recipe for polite company. These quail are meant to be eaten with your hands like God intended. So
That's right.
I love the idea of the grapes. I have not had grapes married to a quail or rough grouse dish, but it makes a ton of sense. And that pop of juice, I can see that working out.
Peaches would work. I mean, peaches would work just as well. And that's another thing that you were talking earlier about, you know, recipes, about how like a lot of beef recipes can just be substituted for whitetail. And I wanted to be like, this man is a liar, because I do write wild game cookbooks for a living.
Yeah.
But you're kind of right. Anyway.
If you understand your ingredients, right? Like a whitetail is a lot leaner than like a red.
Yeah.
You have to like go into it knowing like, okay, I'm probably going to have to introduce some fat into this somehow, or this is going to be dry, or it depends on the preparation. But I think cooking, like people think of woodsmanship as an outdoor skill, but like I really think cooking is, or a knowledge of cooking is just as important as knowing the cover to look for a covey of quail, or knowing how to blood trail a deer. Like being able to take that home and knowing, this is a cut of meat that I need to braise to make it tender. Otherwise, it's going to be really tough. That's essential because the whole point of hunting for me, outside of the spiritual and the friendship and the things that I connect with people, but is to bring home that meat and to be able to use it. Really, like you said, shows respect to the animal and it really completes the whole process of the hunt.
I think yet another great point. Is that you're talking about these kind of conceptual ideas like blood trailing and identifying habitat where you think you should start hunting or concentrate on. And when it comes to recipes, and this will kind of circle back to the grapes versus the peaches here in a second, is that I think that, you know, getting confidence and conceptual confidence in the kitchen is very, very important, where if you want to make this quail dish and you look in your refrigerator and you're like, I don't have grapes. It's like the last thing I want you to do is go to the store. You know, like if there's something else in there that you can identify, and it might not be the best, it might not turn out to be great, but you know, like, well, maybe, you know, I've got some dried apricots and I'll rehydrate them or something. I'll be like, yeah, yeah, that's right. That's like that you're thinking, you know, and that's the same thing as being in the field and veering off in this creek drainage, because it you know, something tells you that that's, you know, through your experience that's what you're going to get. And so I do think that, you know, following recipes to the T is kind of detrimental, and like learning more conceptual things in the kitchen, and it's more fun, and it does add to this entire process and this like generalized like volume of knowledge that you can have that encapsulates hunting from the very, very beginning all the way to the end.
I love that analogy. How many times do we set out on a hunt and we have this plan of, oh, we're going to go down to this cover and hook around and we'll come into the wind and then we'll probably find, and then you get a couple hundred yards into the field and that completely goes out the window. That mm-hmm. applies to cooking a lot as well. Like, this isn't mm-hmm. going, this is cooking way faster than I thought it was going to go. I need mm-hmm. to slow things down. We need to call an audible. Like, there's a lot of similarities in there, so that's interesting you point that out.
Yeah, there's that old NPR show where it's like three things in your kitchen, in your refrigerator, and you make a dish out of it. The Splendid Table, I think, is what it was. And you know, my wife and I did that. We had grilled grouse leftovers. We had a pizza crust, pesto, and blueberries. So we make it a blueberry rough grouse pizza, and people are like, "You're out of your mind!" It was phenomenal. Like the blueberries replace the tomato, you know, it's like, and it's marrying rough grouse that lives in the woods, blueberries. I mean, it's like, it was absolutely incredible. And if people just experiment with some of those things, you can find some magical flavors. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe for some blueberry rough grouse pizza might be a left turn, but it was really good.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, I like that a lot. And I think that it's just like an enjoyment factor as well. It's like sometimes people think that cooking is a chore, just like cleaning your birds is a chore. And so I'm like, I think that if we're able to find like really positive enjoyment throughout the entire process, then it's so much more rewarding.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, you've been a tremendous guest. Thank you so much for writing the article for the Quail Forever Summer Journal. I'm going to go round third and go to a bit of a lightning round here and ask some kind of some quick twitch questions that, you know, we've covered some of this over the course of talking about different recipes. But when I say bobwhite quail, what vegetable do you think of as an immediate, like, oh, that's going to pair? That's the first go-to that I put on the side of bobwhite quail for a vegetable. It like my mind's like, well, he's gonna struggle with this because it depends on the time of the year, right? Because your whole basis for approach is time of the year cooking and local cooking. But what's your quick twitch?
I'm gonna go mushrooms.
Any particular kind of mushroom?
No, I'll have to be vague at that point.
That's cool. It's like whatever. So very earthy. Yeah. Very earthy. All right, so we got quail. We got, and I'm guessing it's a grilled quail because that's your go-to. We got mushrooms. What's a carb you're going to put next to that?
I mean, I don't know if people can see this podcast, but it's a potato. Look at me. I think I'm legally obligated to promote potatoes.
I thought you were going to say potato for your vegetables. So.
Oh, right. Oh, ooh. That's a good one.
Well, he did pick mushroom for the vegetable. I don't know if that counts.
Yeah, either. Right. Oh, my. That was a good one. Potatoes all
any
the way.
Any particular approach to the definitely. Potato? All right.
Potato.
I'm down with that.
I love mashed potatoes.
And what are you washing it down with?
That's a good question. Depending on where I'm at. Now, see, I'll go local on that one. It's going to be probably wine from wherever. Hopefully, you know, if I'm in California. If someone some nice vineyard owner in California sees this podcast, is like, come out and quail hunt. I'll fly you out. I'll be like, I'll be drinking their wine. I'll drink Texas wine here. We've produced fantastic wines here.
Can you throw out a Texas wine that pairs well with quail, grilled quail?
Absolutely. The William Chris Morved would be a favorite. The Ab Astris Tanat would be probably my supreme go-to on that. It's one of my favorite Texas red wines. Very, very good, especially with some mushrooms and some mashed potatoes. It'd be really nice. And then whatever, though. I mean, it could also be a cold glass of water or a beer, depending on the context. But my preference would probably be a red wine.
And sitting at the table sharing this quail with you, living or dead, who would be your guests?
It would be my friend, the landowner down in South Texas. His name is Loncito Cartwright. His given name is Leonidas Cartwright IV. And I think he would be overjoyed to eat a wild quail again. I discussed that in the story, and I think there's nobody else I'd rather enjoy that with than him, because I think it would bring him a lot of happiness to especially eat maybe 6 quail off of his property. With a nice bottle, and he would pick the Tanat, the Ab Astris Tanat, in fact, too. So we'd be halfway there. It would hands down be
outstanding. If folks want to learn a little bit more about you, where would you like to point them? Obviously check out your restaurant in Austin. Where else can people find you, Jesse?
The books, the 2 self-published books, the Hog Book and the Turkey Book, are available on thewildbooks.com, along with a lot of fun merchandise. A Field is available through other
anywhere
online sources. Yeah, you can find it, but you can't find the other books through those sources. Those have to be obtained through us. Meat Eater also does carry both of those books. Or if you're at the restaurant in East Central Austin, we have the books there. And I do it there on Manor Road. And then we also operate what's called the New School of Traditional Cookery, which is the classes. And so that's a lot of like 3-hour classes, usually on a Monday evening when the restaurants close. And then we sometimes offer the 5-day full hunting course as well.
Well, thank you for doing this podcast with us, and most importantly, thank you for writing the story that appears and the recipe that both appear in the Quail Forever Journal. It's really, really awesome to get you engaged in this organization and as a contributor to our publications. It's been really enjoyable, Jesse.
Oh, likewise. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it and appreciate what y'all do.
Ryan, thanks for setting this up. To our listeners, if you're not yet a Quail Forever member, please join at quailforever.org/join. If you're just joining now as you listen to this podcast, your first issue will be the super issue. But drop me or Ryan an email, bobs@quailforever.org or rsparks@quailforever.org, and we will get you a copy of the super issue for listening to this and joining as a result of this podcast, and we'll get that sent out to you. Folks, thank you very much for listening to this episode of On the Wing Podcast. For Jesse Griffiths, for Ryan Sparks, I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.